Broadcasting from the Tiger, 1590. From the state whose motto is, live free or die. This is Veritas. The truth, or facsimile thereof, is out there somewhere. Sponsored in part by
Truth, Justice, and the American Way.
Welcome to Veritas. The truth is out there somewhere on the Tiger 1590. I'm Harvey Warfield, along with Steve Gaudet, who is actually on site. Good afternoon, Steve.
Good afternoon, Harvey.
Great to have you in the studio. See, Steve normally works in Boston. This afternoon, we're going to be talking with Joe Bannister, former IRS special agent. That means he carried a gun, who was forced to resign after he discovered evidence that points to the IRS's record of fraud, deceit, and extortion. Now the IRS is trying to stop him, Joe Bannister, from helping other IRS victims. We'll talk with Joe and his lawyers, Robert Bernhoft and Robert Barnes of the Bernhoft Law Firm, about this unprecedented and clearly Gestapo IRS lockout recently launched against Mr. Bannister. The website for him, for Joe Bannister, is www.freedomabovefortune.com. That tells you a little bit about his personality. But before we get started, some background on your co-host. If you've never listened, Steve Gaudet is a practicing attorney at a Boston law firm. He takes the status quo conventional wisdom view of topics and people we discuss and present. Steve normally doesn't believe that our government would do anything intentionally bad to its citizens. I, Harvey Warfield, on the other hand, I'm a former longtime Boston broadcasting personality. I question authority and conventional wisdom at every opportunity and believe that our government isn't as well behaved as it seems to be. That being said, let's get started. We're talking with Joe Bannister, former IRS special agent. Joe Bannister, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, Harvey and Steve. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
We're doing great. Now, you're also joined by one or two attorneys.
There's supposed to be two. Oh. This is Robert Bernhoft, and with me is my co-counsel, Bob Barnes. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Great.
Good afternoon.
Thank you very much for being on the show with us, with Joe Bannister, this afternoon.
Absolutely.
Joe, I read some emails starting about 2 or 3 weeks ago saying that you are now currently a CPA, correct?
I've been a CPA since 1991.
Since 91, and you were now... That was even during the time when you were in the IRS, correct?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And when you got out of the IRS, which was obviously not something that you had counted on, you went back to being a CPA.
That's right.
And do you help people in their IRS type of situation?
It's not my primary focus in my mm-hmm. practice, but I certainly have helped people who, you know, were up against the 800-pound gorilla, so mm-hmm. to speak, mm-hmm. and felt that I had a... you know, moral and ethical duty to try to help them to the best of my ability.
Mm-hmm. And but about 3 weeks ago or so, that going became kind of tough, didn't it?
Yeah, it's a way that the IRS has chosen, I guess, to let me know that they're out there.
Well, what exactly have they done?
Well, if I could, what I'd like to do is kind of explain what got me to this point.
Absolutely, sure.
And then perhaps my Bob and Bob can fill you in on the legal details.
Okay, that sounds great.
You know, I was in the private sector working for about 3 or 4 years after I graduated from college back in 1986, and I decided to spice up my life a bit and to pursue a career in law enforcement. So I applied to both the FBI and the IRS Criminal Investigation Division. Both agencies, as do many federal agencies, have a position called Special Agent or Criminal Investigator. And so I applied to both those agencies, and being that I was a CPA at the time and still am today, that tended to get them to notice me and, you know, want to recruit me. Fate would have it, the IRS was hiring before the FBI was able to. And so in November of 1993, I actually accepted a position with the IRS Criminal Investigation Division, or CID for short.
Mm-hmm.
And so from November of 1993 on, at least my early plans were that I would spend an entire lifetime career at the IRS and use my financial skills to serve my country.
Mm-hmm.
I was very proud of the fact that I was doing that. I knew that the IRS didn't have that great of a reputation,
mm-hmm.
but I thought that I could do my part to change that.
Mm-hmm.
So from end of 93 until the end of 1996, I really I had a great time doing my job. I did the very high-level investigations,
mm-hmm.
Some of which were done jointly with the FBI, with the Secret Service, the Customs Service, the Postal Service. Again, using my financial skills to protect the Treasury and protect the American taxpayer. And then in December of 96, I was listening to a talk radio show, not unlike your own, where the truth is out there somewhere.
Uh-oh.
And the a lady named D.V. Kidd was speaking about the income tax.
Mm-hmm.
And she was saying, you know, things that people thought would be kind of crazy, like, you know, most Americans aren't required to pay the tax, and information about the 16th Amendment and where our tax money really goes.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard her saying these things, I thought, well, I can't believe this is true, but why don't I look into it just to prove it to myself?
Sure, sure.
And so I spent most all of 1997 and all of 1998, evenings, weekends, looking into her claims, going to the law library, making phone calls to people, all in my personal capacity, just on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I expected that within a very few short weeks of beginning the investigation, I would learn where, you know, the holes in what she was claiming,
mm-hmm.
you know, find out that it was actually a lie, that she was trying to deceive people.
Sure.
And to my surprise, I kept on looking and looking and looking and kept finding more and more evidence that it was, in fact, the IRS that was being the deceiver.
Hmm.
And, you know, my entire professional life at that point was wrapped up around the income tax. I mean, being a CPA and being a gun-carrying, badge-carrying tax enforcement officer, that was my, you know, that was everything about me. So it was a hard pill to swallow. But after a couple of years of looking into this, I realized that it was the agency I was working for that was actually breaking the laws and deceiving people.
Hmm.
And so in February of 1999, I approached my supervisors at the IRS in the San Jose, California IRS CID office,
mm-hmm.
and I showed them the highlights of my analysis, and I asked them to show me the error of my analysis, if any,
mm-hmm.
because what I had found disturbed me a great deal and made me feel that I could not continue to do my job and support and defend the Constitution as I had taken an oath to do.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, my information, my report on this information was not well received, but rather than complying with my request that I get some kind of a response to show me the error of my analysis, they chose to encourage my resignation and sent me home for a week of administrative leave.
To sort of contemplate.
Yeah, to think, so they didn't fire me, but they sent me home saying, you know, what's your next move going to be, because we're not going to answer any of your questions or concerns.
Okay.
So I went home for a little unplanned vacation and got to tell my wife that the career that, you know, we had all sacrificed so much to obtain and excel at, I was perhaps going to have to leave and, you know, not have any money to pay the bills and not have a career anymore, no pension, no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And realized, though, that the IRS was in no manner going to answer any of my concerns, even though I had presented them as a sworn law enforcement person who had a duty to bring these to their attention.
Wow.
They just ignored it all and said, tough, you know, hit the road. So on February 25th of 1999, I issued a resignation letter addressed to Commissioner Rosati, who was the commissioner of the IRS at the time, and stated my concerns that I was, you know, they weren't even addressing any of my issues, not even talking to me about it at all, and just showing me the door, and how that was so much in conflict with the written policies and procedures of the IRS. But nonetheless, it was basically just my final shot across the bow, and I walked out of the agency on February 25th, 1999.
Joe, can I just interrupt you for a second? You said it was contrary to the written procedures of the IRS. What exactly did those procedures say, best to your recollection?
Well, there's a booklet that I was given as a new employee called the Treasury Rules of Conduct.
Hmm.
And those rules are based on actual Treasury regulations that govern the way a government servant is supposed to act and how they're supposed to react when they come across, you know, information.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I remember one particular passage that talked about in a government that is set up. I can't remember how it went, but you know, the government is there to serve the people. A government of, by, and for the people.
Actually, said that in the book.
Yes, I mean, in so many words. Mm-hmm. And that, yeah. I know, with the consent of the governed. You know, the government operates with the consent of the governed. And it actually said that in the Treasury Rules of Conduct. Commissioner Rosati had actually issued a memorandum to all employees just before I resigned. And he said that it is the responsibility of each and every employee to report fraud, waste, and abuse.
Oh.
So, and I have a copy of that memorandum because it came with one of my paychecks. You know, so I mean, and that's just a small sample of the mountains of procedures and direction that employees are given on how to respond when they see fraud, waste, and abuse. I responded in that manner and was told to hit the road. So in February 99, hit the road I did. And that was about 4.5 years ago. And since that time, I haven't done this full time, but I mean, I have been on, 100 to 150 radio shows, been on your show a couple times.
That's right.
Trying to, just tell my story and ask people if they don't think it's a little strange that a special agent from the IRS who they invested $250,000 of training in, they simply dismiss any of his concerns, don't even address them at all, and just tell him, hit the road. That's a bit strange. And then, of course, if you've been publicizing it all, the efforts of the We the People Foundation and the ads in the USA Today, and, I mean, all the efforts of now, it's more than just the agency saying, well, we never heard of a Joe Bannister, or we weren't aware that this was going on. I think everybody's pretty clear on the fact that they can't use that excuse anymore. But what they are doing instead is selectively deciding how they're going to pick apart, you know, those who are speaking up about it. And so in my case, this appears to be the way they've chosen to do it.
And what have they exactly done?
Yeah.
Either of the two Bobs could jump in at this point.
Okay, tell you what, we're going to be bumping up in a minute or two into a break. So yeah, so let's just start it off, I'll have to then stop, and then we'll come back. Okay.
Sure, Harvey. Okay. This is Bob Bernhoff. The IRS has an administrative agency called the Director of Practice,
mm-hmm.
and the Director of Practice is charged with regulating the conduct of advocates before IRS. And the Director of Practice has initiated formal disbarment proceedings against Joe, basically to bar him from representing taxpayers and other individuals before the Internal Revenue Service.
Well, does he formally represent them, or does he just counsel them?
He does. I mean, he has represented people in the past before IRS. He does provide some counseling as well. But the real sub rosa upshot of what they're trying to do is if they could get a suspension or disbarment of Joe's ability to advocate before the IRS,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that information will inevitably be turned over to the California Accountants Disciplinary Board, or the body that regulates the accounting profession. And the clear goal here is to have his CPA license pulled.
Really? I mean,
yeah.
Man.
Now, Bob, even though this is an administrative agency, do they still have to follow certain procedures in that, for example, file a complaint? I mean, are you able to see what their case is made of?
Yes, Steve. What they did is they first notified Joe of their intention to file a complaint about 9-10 months ago, actually going on a year, actually. And then we had an administrative conference with Chief Counsel of IRS in San Francisco, and we talked about, you know, how they viewed the situation, what our view was, and Joe made a decision at that point. They were looking for him to stipulate to advocacy misconduct, and he refused to do that. And so we advised IRS that Joe would not be stipulating to a 3-year disbarment or suspension, and mm-hmm. that they would have to bring on their complaint. Now, the case has been assigned to a administrative protection agency, an EPA administrative law judge. The ALJs sit in Washington, D.C., and this is intended to provide a form of neutral arbitration or adjudication of the IRS's complaint. They allege two parts to the complaint. The first, that Joe made frivolous arguments before the Internal Revenue Service when advocating for his clients. And second, that he engaged in personal sanctionable misconduct, disreputable conduct, as they phrase it, by not filing tax returns for a period of years.
Okay, now, I tell you what, we have the two, those two reasons. We're going to have to come back because we're bumping into a break. Let's talk about those when we come back. Steve, I know, has got some questions about it, okay? We'll be back with Joe Bannister, former IRS special agent. After a quick break, you're listening to Veritas. The truth is out there somewhere here on the Tiger 1590 with your hosts Harvey Warfield and Steve Gaudet. This is Veritas. The truth is out there somewhere. We'll be right back.
This is Tom O'Brien. Right after Veritas, join me for a look at the latest moves in stocks, bonds, and gold. We'll dissect and bisect all the action and give you tools you can use to position yourself for the next move in these volatile markets. Today, from 4 to 6 on the Tiger 1590.
Did you know that you don't actually owe any money on your mortgage? That you've been needlessly paying it all along? Did you know that a company can show you how to stop paying month after month and how to own your home free and clear? And that there are no large upfront costs, and that after your mortgage is fully paid, you'll actually wind up with thousands of dollars in your pocket, tax-free. Sounds pretty good. No more mortgage payments, owning your home free and clear, and thousands of dollars in your pocket that's tax-free and yours to do with as you please. If you'd like more information, email mentor2@AOL.com. That's mentor2@AOL.com. Mentor2@AOL.com. Over 1,600 people are doing so right now, paying off their mortgages in 60 days. Email mentor2@AOL.com. That's mentor2@AOL.com. This program valid in the U.S. only. Mentor2@AOL.com. Put mortgage 57 in the subject line. Mentor2@AOL.com.
Weekdays, we analyze the market. Nights and weekends, we analyze the games. It's Stocks and Jocks on the Tiger 1590.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's gonna do it? You? You don't want the truth.
We're back with Joe Bannister, former IRS special agent, forced to resign after he discovered evidence that points to the IRS's record of fraud, deceit, and extortion, and who was recently locked out by the IRS. Bob, before we left, you were actually articulating the two counts in which IRS is pursuing Joe, and I thought the first count, that is raising frivolous arguments before the agency, might be something worth pursuing a little. And my question is this. One, in the administrative proceeding, are you allowed to introduce evidence, and are they then required to respond to that evidence? And what I'm thinking of is, in fact, raising arguments that Joe has raised in the past vis-a-vis the IRS and the tax, such as a very simple question, where in the IRS tax code does it say that a U.S. citizen has to pay an income tax? During this proceeding, are you allowed to introduce this type of evidence?
It's an excellent question, Steve. This is Steve Gaudet?
Yes.
Yes, Steve. The scope of the administrative proceeding is very narrow. We have filed a motion for discovery. We don't hold out much hope that we'll get pretrial discovery. The trial is set for December 1st through 5. Now, the government's position, the IRS position, and they filed a motion in limine, and for your listeners, what that means is they filed a motion asking the court to bar Joe from testifying regarding certain subjects and from introducing certain evidence. And essentially, the motion in limine requests that Joe not be able to put on any defense whatsoever. Now, we're hopeful, of course, that the court takes a look at that and recognizes that, of course, as a matter of fundamental due process, before a man can be stripped of his livelihood, that he's entitled not just to a pro forma boilerplate hearing, but a hearing at which he can actually defend himself through personal testimony and evidence.
And Bob, can you have, during these administrative proceedings, can you have an interlocutory appeal to actually a district court, a federal district court?
Yes, if we do not like the court's decision in any respect after the conclusion of the hearing trial, our appeal lies to the U.S. District Court. In this case, would be for the District Court of Northern California in San Francisco. That appeal lies under the Administrative Procedures Act, 5 U.S.C. Section 701.
Yeah.
Now, we do have the ability to file for interlocutory appeal on certain issues. Some of those would be discretionary with the court. We could also use writ practice, mandamus or prohibition, if we get into a point in the hearing where we believe that a very critical issue has been wrongly decided.
I mean, even I would think, and again, I'm not asking you to forecast what your strategy is, but even this motion, I would think, may be quite offensive, and that's something that may want to rise to the level of an appeal, interlocutory appeal. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, I'm going to ask Bob Barnes to comment on that.
Sure, yeah, I mean, essentially they've filed two motions. One is a motion to bar him from talking about any of these beliefs, that the good, even though the beliefs are the actual basis for the complaint being filed, though the complaint was very unspecific in characterizing the nature of those beliefs, and they refused to allege certain facts such that Joe could defend against specific factual allegations. They just made general, vague, conclusory allegations that he had talked somehow about this provision of the code that by necessity violated the regulations about frivolous or false opinions, though they failed to detail how any of the opinions were frivolous or false. But in addition, they've also moved for a summary disbarment. They've moved for a summary judgment on the issue without any hearing being held at all, even though that appears to be a clear-cut violation of the Administrative Procedures Act and the IRS's own regulations.
Right. Now, my understanding is that you have to exhaust your administrative relief. Is that all? Is that included in this type of a hearing?
Yes.
Okay. So before actually you move on to district court, you actually have to, in some sense, play this game out.
That's exactly right.
Could we just reiterate what the two charges were against him? Okay.
Sure. It's one of those situations where it's difficult to detail the charges because the IRS has itself refused to detail the charges.
Oh, okay. But what you can make of it?
Sure. They first charged him with rendering opinions on behalf of two taxpayers that they considered false and frivolous.
Mm-hmm.
Then, just several weeks ago, they amended the complaint, even though the rules and procedures do not appear to permit this particular form of amendment.
Mm-hmm.
They amended the complaint to include supplemental charges that he had that he'd willfully failed to file his tax return.
Oh, okay.
And in that case, they never gave him notice that they were going to do this. Apparently, they've now admitted that there's a parallel criminal investigation that they've been conducting of Joe for several years. They appear to be monitoring his political conversations because they keep referencing the basis for initiating these proceedings are his appearances on talk radio shows or on 60 Minutes and the like.
Now, and I hate to keep on hammering this, but I find this almost incredible. Going back to the frivolous argument, are you saying in their complaint that, in fact, they did not specify precisely what they meant by a frivolous argument?
That's exactly right. In fact,
doesn't our Constitution guarantee that, in fact, the defense will have sufficient information in order to mount a defense?
That's exactly right. And in fact, we have filed a motion to dismiss the complaint on Joe's behalf on just those grounds. That all they did was say that he talked about a section of the code, and what happened here, you know, the unfortunate pattern that the agency has taken as it relates to Joe, he had asked for a hearing, and no hearing was ever conducted on behalf of this particular client, or what they called a hearing was basically a short phone call in which the facts and legal issues were never litigated at all. And they just said, well, you talked about this particular issue, and we consider that frivolous, without saying what the definition of frivolous is, without saying what the factual allegations were, without going into any detail at all.
I would point out that there's a as with Joe. First of all, I have to say something about Joe Bannister. Joe Bannister is a great American, and I don't use terms like that cavalierly or loosely. He is a man who has great integrity, great honesty, and great courage, and he's gone forward and stood on principle here, and he essentially asked the government a couple of questions. He did this investigative research. He presented a professional investigative report to his superiors. And he said, look, please show me the section of the code that makes an individual liable for the Subtitle A individual income tax and the law that requires that individual to file a Form 1040, you know, without violating his Fifth Amendment right. And the government's response is criminal investigation, grand jury, and civil disbarment. And I have to tell you, I find that morally repugnant. That is undemocratic. It is un-American. And I would briefly advert to a case you may have heard of in Memphis, Tennessee. Bernice Kuglin, a FedEx DC-10 captain.
Yeah, we had them on the show, yeah.
Yeah, they were charged with willful failure to file a tax evasion. I was co-counsel with Larry Becraft, and Bernie got up there on the stand and said, look, you know, I've been asking the government for 10 years to answer these questions, and they refused to do it. So the government's response to citizens asking intelligent, good-faith questions apparently is either to try and throw them in jail or to strip them of their ability to make a living. I find that offensive.
I find it unbelievable that a servant government would act like that.
But, you know, the other thing, too, and Joe, I think, heard the show, that we, this is actually my moment of conversion, is because what was happening is we kept on inviting, and I'm just going to loosely term the crowd tax protesters, because that's how I felt about them. And, you know, I was running out of arguments, so I actually called the IRS in Washington, and they said, sure, we'll provide you with individuals from the IRS, but we'll contact our Boston office because that's close by and blah, blah, blah. So we got it all organized. We sent them all sorts of information, gave them about a month and a half lead time.
This is information that they requested us.
Right, and so we gave it to them. And so I was actually quite excited because someone now is going to put this argument to rest. Well, let me tell you, and we have it on tape, gentlemen, we had two IRS employees on, and this was their specialty. That's how they were introduced to us, is that this is how they devote their time. And they were good guys. The problem was is that they couldn't answer the question because the first question was, all right, gentlemen, you know, where in the tax statute does it explicitly state that a U.S. citizen earning a wage or income in the United States owes federal tax? And then there was just dead silence. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, we lost them on the phone or something, so now we have dead... Well, you know, and we said, hello, and they said, you know, no, we're here. And I'm like, well, what's the delay? And you could hear them punching keypads. And I said, guys, you can't tell me that this is the first time somebody's ever asked you. So through an hour-long radio show, whatever, 50 minutes, they came to the conclusion that, in fact, the statute does not explicitly state that.
But they said it's in there somewhere.
No, they said you have to infer it, basically.
Let me make a comment about inferences, particularly in criminal law.
Yeah.
Criminal statutes are construed strictly against the government in favor of the citizen.
That's,
we just don't deprive people of their liberty unless the obligation of the law is absolutely clear.
That's right.
And, you know, this goes to an important point, an overarching point. The Internal Revenue Code is at best a walking, talking due process violation.
Mm-hmm.
No citizen can conceivably look at that code in all of its thousands and ten thousands of pages of text and find clearly what their obligations are.
Yep.
And to put people at risk of civil forfeiture, asset forfeiture, wage levy, and ultimately criminal prosecution and significant federal jail time under those circumstances is just a violation of some of our most cherished principles.
And Bob, Larry, when we have Larry on the show, he told us that case after case, the assistant U.S. attorneys always file this motion in limine so that it precludes bringing in the statute, precludes bringing in the fundamental issue upon which somebody is charged. So were you surprised at all that, in fact, the government is filing this motion?
No. It's you don't want to become jaded. I was not surprised, but my moral sensibilities continue to be finely tuned, and it was surprising and shocking in that sense. To think that you can allege an administrative complaint against a man and then seek to deprive him of the fundamentals of his defense, again, strikes me as being particularly un-American, tyrannical. That's not the democratic process.
It's not common sense.
That is exactly. It defies common sense. You don't have to be a lawyer or any specialist to figure out that a man or woman is entitled to a fair shot, a fair day in court, where they get to testify on their own behalf about their beliefs and introduce evidence that would support their defense.
And let's be very clear about this, and that's exactly what we're talking about, is that when the government makes a charge, it's supposed to be specific enough so that the defendant can understand what he's being charged with and mount a defense. And in this case, and in what Larry Becraft has presented to us, the government just is rather obscure with its charge, and how can you possibly mount a defense?
You can't. It's tyrannical. Listen, yeah. We're bumping into a break. We'll be back with Joe Bannister, former IRS special agent, after a quick break. We're also speaking with Robert Bernhoft and Robert Barnes of the Bernhoft Law Firm, who is representing Joe Bannister. You're listening to Veritas. The truth is out there somewhere on the Tiger 1590. We'll be right back.
The Tom O'Brien Show, weekday mornings at 10, weekday afternoons at 4, on the Tiger 1590.
Did you know you can write off your credit card debt, even if your debt is as high as $100,000? You can legally write off your credit card debt up to $100,000, up to 6 cards. It's not a loan, it's not debt consolidation, it's not a home equity loan that could put your home in jeopardy if you default on it. It's a program that can eliminate your credit card debt up to $100,000, up to 6 credit cards. It doesn't cover gas or department store cards or American Express, but it does cover Visa, MasterCard, and Discover cards. You can write off up to 6 different cards, up to $100,000 of credit card debt, and the program allows you to get a perfect credit rating after your credit card debt has been written off. It comes with a 100% money-back guarantee, and the program has never had to refund any money. If you'd like information, email mentor2@AOL.com. That's M-E-N-T-O-R, the number 2, at AOL.com. Write off your credit card debt up to $100,000, up to 6 credit cards. Email mentor2@AOL.com. M-E-N-T-O-R 2, the number 2, at AOL.com. Put the phrase write off in the subject line. Mentor2@AOL.com. This program is only valid in the U.S. and Canada. You can legally write off your credit card debt up to $100,000, up to 6 cards. Mentor2@AOL.com.
When it's a work day, it stops. On nights and weekends, it's jocks. That's why you listen. Financial talk while you work, sports talk while you play. The Tiger 1590.
Okay, we're back. This is Veritas. The truth is out there somewhere. We're talking with Joe Bannister, former IRS agent. That means he carried a gun. He was forced to resign, and we'll get to that in just a moment. We've got to do some business here. Reminder, Veritas is not responsible for advertising content and makes no warranties or guarantees about the products or services advertised. Let's tell them who's coming up next week. Next week, it's Chris Milligan, author of Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. Chris tells the real story of this insidious Yale secret society. Doesn't give us any fluff. And a reminder, 3 generations of Bushes have been members. Visit the website, fleshingoutskullandbones.com. And a week after that, it's coming up to the 40th anniversary of the very tragic Kennedy assassination. We have the author of The Kennedy Mutiny, What Really Happened in Dallas, November 22nd, 1963. The author is Will Fritz. That book is brand new. It's been described as close to the real story as anyone will ever come. Today's guest was supposed to have been Rick Stanley. He's the constitutional activist, former U.S. Senate candidate, enemy of the state, and self-avowed extremist on the order of our forefathers. He's in jail for carrying a gun up in Denver. Hopefully we'll get him sometime in December. Our email address is veritasradio@AOL.com, our website, veritasradio.com.
What I'd like to try to get into, and I'm not sure that you guys would be all that comfortable, and I understand, so if you want us to defer this subject, please, by all means, just let us know. But how do you actually prepare a case? What is your strategy for going into this this hearing when, in fact, at this point, all you can do is take an educated guess at what the government is asserting?
Yeah, what Steve, what we're doing is the government owes a duty of candor to its citizens, and as we see individuals like Bernice Kugler and Bob Shultz from We the People asking questions of the government, they owe a duty of candor, and responsible public policy officials, I believe, agree with that. I believe that there are thoughtful, good men and women in the Beltway in D.C. that don't agree with these draconian policies, and it's our job, I think, in some sense, to reach out to them and to convince them that there are responsible people on this side of the aisle that wish to engage in a dialogue to resolve these questions. This isn't about egos, it's not about parochialism, it's about the citizens' right to ask questions of their government and to get direct, non-evasive answers. And our strategy at trial is going to be to put the government to its proof. They get their case in chief, they get to go first, they're calling some witnesses, they're bringing in an attorney from, I believe, Chief Counsel's office, Director of Practice in the district, Mr. Finns, and he'll be there to testify about the law. And we intend to question Mr. Finns about these legal assertions that have been made, and we're going to put the government to its proof and see if we can get them to answer these fundamental questions at this hearing.
That would be fantastic to finally get it on record what the government's position is.
But do you really think that that will happen? Come on, when they bring a witness on, they say, well, was the guy on Main Street on January 23rd? And they go, yep, okay, and then they, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
they always bring in stupid witnesses.
Yeah, but there's an opportunity for cross-examination.
That's
okay.
Right.
All right. Okay.
We get to cross, and we'll have some, I expect that it's going to be interesting cross-examination.
Oh, it should be very interesting.
But let me ask you this. In terms of the rules of evidence, is your cross limited in scope to the actual direct?
No, I don't believe that it is. I believe that our cross would be broad enough to embrace not only the allegations of the complaint, as sketchy and insufficient as they are, also the testimony that the government elicits on direct, but also cross-examination going to Joe's affirmative and special defenses.
Yes.
We have alleged that this is a retaliatory administrative disbarment action, that they are violating Mr. Bannister's First Amendment speech rights, that conducting a concurrent criminal and civil proceeding with respect to these allegations is a clear Fifth Amendment Fifth Amendment violation, self-incrimination, and a due process violation.
Yeah.
So we will attempt to. I've been very impressed with the court's even-handedness to this point, and we expect that the court will give us a fair shot out there in San Francisco, December 1st.
Yes. In fact, one of the more shocking admissions to come out from the government in this case was that it is the policy of the Director of Practice to continue with civil investigations, even though there's a parallel criminal investigation whenever the AUSA or the Criminal Investigation Department wants them to do that, which is a rather extraordinary admission on their part.
Now, are you guys, let me ask you about the discovery process. Are there any off-limits, any boundaries on the discovery?
The IRS's position is that we're not allowed any discovery.
What?
In fact, they filed a response to our motion for discovery, saying we should not be allowed to be given any written interrogatory, any request for production, any documents, any request for admission, or anything else.
That's outrageous. Well, what's the status of that now?
It is pending before the administrative law judge.
But Steve is dumbfounded at this point. He can't even ask a question. That is just unbelievable.
If I could jump in here just to say, this is the reason that I'm going through this. Because this is what they do to people who can't afford to defend themselves or don't know how to.
Or can't be on the radio.
And they get away, the IRS gets away with this, and they bully people, and people don't have the tools to be able to fight back. And that's what bullying was about in elementary school. For me, that's what bullying was about when I was in high school. That's what bullying is about, and that's what the IRS does. So now, if they're going to bully me, then people are going to know how they did it.
Yep.
Yeah, no, wait a minute. I just want to back up now. Is there any type of hyperbole for effect here, gentlemen? I mean, are you saying that the IRS has filed a motion to preclude discovery?
What happened is we filed a motion for this discovery to go forward, and their response was that the administrative law judge should deny all discovery.
But how does that make sense? I mean, let's just say, for example, you're a 1L, you're a first-year law student. All right. Oh, maybe your second year. You've already gone through con law, and you've studied administrative agencies. How do you put something like that in the context of constitutional law and the APA?
Yeah, Bob Barnes, when we were off air, he had commented to me and Joe that these ideas of process, administrative procedure, and civil procedure, any 1L, first-year law student, could take a look at the complaint and recognize it was deficient. And similarly, any 1L that had gone through Civ Pro 1, Civil yeah. Procedure 1, would know that you have to have discovery in a civil proceeding
yeah.
so that you can distill the issues to be determined, if any, at
yeah.
trial.
Yeah.
This is a fundamental tenet of
yes.
civil procedure that's been around for 100 years since we went to the Civil Procedure Code,
yes.
The field codes that were adopted in New York and then spread throughout the state.
Yeah.
So it's odd. You ask for hyperbole. If I start using adjectives, they're going to be overwrought. And so I'll leave it to say that we're going to go forward and put on the absolute best defense that we can for Joe under the circumstances. We're hopeful because the court has been even-handed and fair to this point that some of these decisions go our way. But in any event, we will conduct the hearing and we'll make the best record that we can. And if ultimately we are legally or as a practical matter unsatisfied with the court's decision, we will pursue the appeal.
Okay, now, the court has been fairly fair. However, it's the prosecution, which is on behalf of the IRS, that has said, can't do the discovery. Is anyone what is going on
yes.
in this arena?
Yeah, there should be. We've got the Office of Chief Counsel in San Francisco that's heading up the prosecution, the disbarment prosecution, if you will. We expect that there is some sort of policy administrative supervision. But, I would point out as a general matter that the government is simply not held to the same standards in litigation that private individuals are and private attorneys.
Mm.
And I can tell you, and I don't want to, be untoward to my adversaries on the other side of the aisle, because it's not, I don't think it's productive. I
yeah.
think you put your comments on the litigation field and at the hearing. But I will say that there are certain absolutely stunning admissions and stunning arguments or assertions made in the government's various filings that if I would say some of those things in the pleading, I have no doubt that I would be sanctioned and probably get my ticket pulled for at least 90 days.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just an example of that, they have argued in their summary disbarment motion, which they called a summary judgment motion, that Joe had not produced any discoverable information that refuted the allegations, and yet in the very same pleading they're asking, or in other pleading filed at the same time, wanting to prevent him from conducting any discovery.
Oh, geez. That's unbelievable.
The government is such a monolith, it would seem. How can we even justify the fact that we consider the government a servant government rather than a master government?
This well, the modern American tax system needs to be abolished and replaced with something that's constitutional.
Yep.
What you have here is a situation, whenever you have a doctrinal breach at the core, what you see are these eruptions at the surface. Right now in the federal court system, we've got First Amendment tax exceptions to the First Amendment.
Bob, I'm sorry, I've got to interrupt. We're going into a break. Would you, when we come back, could you continue with that
yeah.
thought, if you would?
Absolutely.
This is Veritas. You're listening to Harvey Warfield and Steve Gaudet on the Tiger 1590. Veritas, the truth is out there somewhere with Joe Bannister and his lawyer team. We'll be right back.
This is Tom O'Brien. Right after Veritas, join me for a look at the latest moves in stocks, bonds, and gold. We'll dissect and bisect all the action and give you tools you can use to position yourself for the next move in these volatile markets. Today, from 4 to 6 on the Tiger, 1590.
Here are three quick questions on our money system. Is there really any money? Who actually runs and controls the Federal Reserve? Who actually funds a mortgage loan? Well, here are the answers to two of them. The U.S. money system is not what it seems, and we can show you why. The Federal Reserve is as federal as Federal Express, and run and controlled by private bankers. And you'll have to email us for the answer to the third question, who actually funds a mortgage? we can show you how it's possible to pay off your mortgage in as little as 60 days. Over 1,600 excited people are doing so right now. You can eliminate your mortgage and never have to pay for it again. If you'd like more information, email mentor2@AOL.com. That's mentor2@AOL.com. Lawfully eliminate your mortgage in as little as 60 days. This program valid in the U.S. only. Email mentor2@AOL.com. Put mortgage 57 in the subject line. That's mentor2@AOL.com.
Weekdays, we analyze the market. Nights and weekends, we analyze the games. It's Stocks and Jocks on the Tiger 1590.
Okay, we're back. This is Veritas. The truth is out there somewhere. A very startling show that you're listening to today. We're speaking with Joe Bannister and his legal team, Bob Bernhoff and Bob Barnes. The situation is they're helping him fight an unlawful action by what is supposedly a servant government. Now, I think it was Bob Bernhoff. You were starting to give your philosophy on this.
Yeah, regarding the modern American income tax, what we have right now, we've created tax exceptions to the First Amendment, right to free speech, association, tax exceptions to the Fourth Amendment, tax exceptions to the Fifth Amendment. In fact, federal jurisprudence is littered with these exceptions. And now, I care about the law. I believe that what separates America from almost all other countries in the world is the rule of law doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And I care about the fabric of the law. And I think that certain policymakers believe that they can create these tax exceptions to fundamental constitutional principle in our law, and that they won't bleed out into other areas. In other words, they'll only be applied to the tax to protect the tax, and they won't infect the rest of our jurisprudence. And I would submit that that is not the case.
Mm-hmm.
That in fact they're rending the Constitution. They are creating Swiss cheese out of fundamental American jurisprudence, and this is a very, very dangerous thing to do.
So you're almost saying, oh, I'm sorry about you, but actually I'm quite surprised by what you just said, because I wasn't aware of these exceptions. You're saying that in essence the Constitution is subservient to tax.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no question that is correct. When you look at basic Fifth Amendment jurisprudence, for example, you will find cases that explicitly say, well, we're going to create a tax exception,
right.
Although one particular case actually came out and said that. So some of the policymakers are a little bit more candid than others. But that's precisely what's happening. In policymakers' zeal to protect the modern American tax, they have done exactly what I've suggested, created all these tax exceptions. And it's very frustrating, being someone who cares deeply about the law, to watch this happen. And my point about breaching doctrine, when you start breaching core doctrine, bad things happen on the periphery.
Yes.
And that's when you start to see Fifth Amendment violations, First Amendment violations. That's when we see a principled man like Joe Bannister being targeted for retaliatory action on behalf of an executive branch administrative agency. And that's why these things happen, because we've left some of our first principles at the door.
I just can't believe that, Bob. Now, have any of these exceptions been challenged and gone up to the highest court, the Supreme Court?
Well, the court gave us United States v. Cheek in 1986, which was the Supreme Court actually gave us back true mens rea in tax prosecutions.
Yeah.
Prior to Cheek, essentially, the district courts would direct a verdict against a defendant who presented a reliance defense, such as Bernie Coogan did in Memphis.
Yeah, yeah.
And they would say, look, jury, the beliefs that this defendant has talked about, you have to determine whether they're objectively reasonable. Well, mens rea is a subjective matter by definition.
Yes, yes.
And so what they were doing, and of course when the majority of Americans believe everybody's got to file and pay, those are virtually directed verdicts, and that's what U.S. v. Cheek gave us back. And Cheek says, look, there's no objective reasonableness test that can't be, that's unconstitutional. It's a jury question whether they find the defendant's testimony regarding beliefs to be credible. So, but with the exception of U.S. v. Cheek, the Supreme Court has not taken up many cases that present these important questions.
And why do you think that is?
Well, the Supreme Court is more of an administrative body these days. One of the problems, a really serious problem that thoughtful people care about, is the bureaucratization of the federal court system.
Yeah.
And with under Justice Chief Justice Rehnquist's leadership, and he's had good leadership, they only take about 80 to 90 cases a year. And frankly, many of the justices on the high court are interested in other issues and don't have a particular interest in controversial tax questions.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, listen, we've run out of time. I want to thank Joe Bannister. Joe, good success, best of success with your case. It's coming up December 1st through the 5th.
Yeah, if anybody could visit my website at freedomabovefortune.com, it would certainly help.
And we also want to thank Robert Bernhoff and Robert Barnes today, your lawyer team, for giving us some very startling and frightening information. Thank you guys so much. And the next closest show that we have coming up will be the 11th of December. Perhaps we can revisit this and find out what the heck happened in court, okay?
Thank you, guys.
All right. You're welcome. That's all the time we have for Veritas. The truth is out there somewhere. We'll be back next Thursday with Chris Milligan, author of Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. Thanks very much again to Joe Bannister, Robert Bernhoff, and Robert Barnes. FreedomAboveFortune.com. Thanks also to Bill, our producer. That's it. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Steve Gaudet. The Tom O'Brien Show is next on the Tiger 59. Thanks, Steve.
This has been Veritas. The search for the truth continues next week at 3 p.m. In the meantime, email us with comments or questions at VeritasRadio, all one word, at AOL.com. VeritasRadio at AOL.com. The truth is out there. Somewhere.